Hey folks, Devin Hubbard here with a quick update on things. We've been working pretty diligently on COVID-related innovation projects and fast tracks, and that squeezed our production schedule just a bit. Don't worry though, we have some new episodes that are on their way. In this episode of Guidewire, we had a unique opportunity to discuss the effects of the COVID-19 outbreak on interventional radiology practice at Duke University Hospitals. Please note that the audio quality in this episode is different as we recorded it over video conference to maintain social distancing. We hope that you are staying safe and that you enjoy this episode.
Welcome to Guidewire, a direct line to medical device innovation. We are the boots on the ground inside of healthcare working to uncover and solve high-impact, unmet medical needs.
All right. Well, I'll start off with a quick introduction of myself. So I'm Devin Hubbard. I'm the host of the Guidewire podcast. I wear a couple hats. I do medical device design instruction in the Joint Department of Biomedical Engineering at UNC and NC State. I also wear another hat with NC Tracks inside of Fast Tracks, where we do medical device innovation, and I'm the lead design engineer there. So today we are joined by Dr. John Martin, and we are co-hosting with Gabe Lee, who also works with Fast Tracks. So Gabe, if you don't mind giving a quick intro.
Absolutely, yeah. So my name is Gabe. I'm a medical student over at Duke that does some work with Fast Tracks and Devin. I also have spent the last year doing research with Dr. Martin. I'm interested in going into IR. It's great being here today with two guys who wear many, many hats, and I only wear one, so they can make up for my lack of hats.
Dr. Martin, if you don't mind introducing yourself.
I am currently an assistant professor of interventional radiology at Duke University. Until a couple of years ago, I was an assistant professor of the same at Emory University in Atlanta, and I have mentored numerous teams through the Emory-Georgia Tech collaboration in their senior capstone design process.
Outstanding. Well, thanks for joining us today. And Gabe, I have to say, I think you're not giving yourself credit for the number of hats that you actually wear, but we can get into that in another episode, maybe. So today we're going to have a conversation about COVID and specifically how COVID has affected the practice of IR and perhaps some of the unintended or unseen consequences of that. So Dr. Martin, thanks for joining us today. I think the easiest and biggest question to start with is sort of to give a 10,000 foot view of how this pandemic has affected the practice of IR, at least from your perspective, maybe specifically at Duke. But if you can speak to or have any insight on sort of nationally or internationally, that would be also really interesting. I'm curious to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, for sure. There's been a really heterogeneous effect on the practice of interventional radiology. And let me start by just giving a little bit of reference to what interventional radiology encompasses. So We perform roughly 80 different minimally invasive procedures. And these procedures can be as minor as placing a catheter through which hemodialysis can be performed, or as major as going into the liver from multiple different trajectories and creating an artificial shunt through that liver, connecting one source of blood flow into the liver to a source of blood flow out of the liver, essentially bypassing the liver without ever doing anything more than placing a small pinhole into the neck. Or for someone that has uterine fibroids or a malignancy in the liver or kidneys or the lungs, we can go in through a little pinhole in the wrist, move a catheter through the arteries, and deliver treatment into those tumors. So the impact of COVID really depends on what category of procedure we're talking about. If we're talking about emergent procedures, so people who are having bleeding, that bleeding needs to stop, or they have big blood clots and they need those blood clots removed, those cases are really carrying forward. If we're talking about someone that maybe has been living with uterine fibroids for 5-10 years, and the symptoms have finally pushed them to present for treatment, well, we may defer the intervention on that individual for now.
And right before we started the podcast here, we were just sort of chatting. You mentioned that it seemed interesting. I was a little surprised by what you mentioned, which was that it seems like for IR, the procedures may have sort of shifted a little bit. And perhaps, you know, a lot of, you know, general surgery and elective procedures were essentially canceled. I mean, we're pretty far in at this point. We're like 8-9 weeks into the pandemic here in the United States. And I wanted to get your flavor on the IR side of things, because it sounded to me like your procedure volume hadn't decreased as much as some of the other practices. And it was kind of unique, I think. I want our audience to hear about that. Can you touch on that a little bit?
What we did is any procedure that we felt was elective that could be deferred 4 weeks or longer was deferred. So those cases, again, like embolization of uterine fibroids, those were deferred. So none of those cases are happening at the current time. However, any cases that involve the treatment of malignancy, dialysis, bleeding, or blood clots, those cases still need to occur. Otherwise, the patient will have a direct negative impact. And our cases are done without any general anesthesia, and they're done without requiring an admission to the hospital. So these patients are just presenting as an outpatient, being done with low utilization of resources, and then going home to recover. So because of that, a slice of our outpatient procedures were deferred, but an equal number were continuing to be done. Additionally, on a normal daily basis, on a regular day, about 50% of our procedures are being done on an emergent or urgent basis of existing inpatients. So people who come to the hospital after an accident or come with a new blood clot in their lungs, and they need that procedure done today. So those cases are still happening. So the 50% of in-hospital cases are still occurring. And then of the 50% outpatient, 25% were reduced, but that 25% remained. So you have roughly the 75% that are still going. However, there's some cases that we may share. So for example, a procedure could potentially be done in the operating room, or it could be done in interventional radiology. Well, now the resources that are used in the operating room are maybe no longer worth that utilization, right? So the small additional safety or benefit that may come from it being done openly in the operating room is offset by the utilization of general anesthesia and a longer recovery as an inpatient. And so instead, those cases are being deferred from the operating room and shifted to interventional radiology. And so those cases are somewhat replacing some of the cases that we had deferred that were truly elective. So overall, our total volumes are down about 15%.
Yeah, I know for some other practices, the volumes are much further down. So it's interesting. Do you think that that's, have you, maybe with some of your other colleagues at other institutions, have you heard similar kind of reports or?
Yeah, so this is where it gets really heterogeneous. So interventional radiology, when practiced in a sort of private practice outpatient setting, is much more heavily weighted towards these elective procedures. And so those practices are much more impacted. Their volumes are very significantly down, 50 or 80%. Other academic institutions, depending on where they are, their resources may have dramatically shifted towards COVID patients. So for example, some of my colleagues in New York City are describing a setting where the hospital is completely full, but it's completely full with patients who, for the most part, don't require interventional radiology procedures. And those patients who may benefit from IR procedures are actually staying at home and not even presenting to the hospital out of fear of contracting COVID-19. So their volumes are down on both outpatients and inpatients, even though the overall volume of patients in the hospital is over maximum capacity.
Yeah, I think I've spoken to some other providers and they're seeing similar trends with folks staying at home, and it kind of, I don't know, it speaks to the urgency of some problems. It's funny, you know, I was chatting with somebody from hospital medicine at UNC the other day, and the comment they made was, you know, what concerns them about folks staying home is that there's people and individuals that have unstable conditions that may not show up to the hospital when they need to. And so their concern was specifically surrounding individuals with some silent sort of cardiac issues. But that's interesting that you're echoing this sort of same feeling that we're hearing from other providers as well. You have a background in design, or at least you've participated with design. And in your time at Emory, you worked with design teams. And so I would be remiss if I didn't bring up a question about devices related to COVID-specific indications or procedures in the IR space in particular. Is anybody doing any new COVID-related innovation? Has it changed the way that folks are thinking about devices or even their practice, long-term, short-term, et cetera? And then before we started this, we also hinted at, you know, the regulatory pathways are still intact. And so there's other routes to get your products on the shelves, temporarily at least. I'm kind of curious to hear your thoughts from the IR perspective on innovation happening related to COVID.
So again, a lot of the cases that we're doing in interventional radiology related to COVID are the same cases that we were doing before COVID. What's mm-hmm. changed is how we are doing those cases. And so the innovation would come not necessarily as much directly related to what is being done to the patient as much as how can you protect the patient or protect their provider or protect, mm-hmm. you know, transport. So how can we do these cases instead of bringing the patient down to interventional radiology? How can we get the same safety and efficacy of doing the procedure in the patient's bed?
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Well, can we pause? I have to ask questions here because procedure suites are designed to enable the procedure itself to be carried out in the best possible way, presumably as safely and effectively as possible. It seems like there's a risk-benefit situation here where clearly under these circumstances, the risk is worth it. Is that accurate or am I missing something or misunderstanding something about that?
That is completely accurate.
Yeah.
Because in the process of the patient coming down, you are thinking to yourself that if this is an actively infected, coughing patient who is spreading viral load everywhere they go, mm-hmm. that's the transporters that are interacting with them. It's the nurses that are down in interventional radiology. It's the room that now needs to have a HEPA filter brought in and cleaned and be no additional procedures in there for 2 hours afterwards. It's potentially the hallways or the elevators or anyone that you go past. So all of those things are now a part of the risk-benefit analysis, whereas mm-hmm. usually they would not be. And so then when you think about that and you think about a case, a procedure that you can perform with very minimal additional risk of doing it in the patient's bed, well, now that starts to look like a really good idea. And so instead, yeah. what we've been doing for certain cases only is an attending physician, one technologist, and one nurse will come up from interventional radiology and do the procedure in the patient's room.
Are we talking like line placement or are we talking about more invasive procedures?
We are definitely talking about line placement and also a few other more invasive procedures. So for example, if someone were to have acute cholecystitis, they could potentially go to the operating room to have their gallbladder removed, or as a temporizing agent, you could put a catheter into the gallbladder to decompress it, let it just drain out and instead of bursting. And
right.
so we would place those catheters normally down in the procedure suite, but we would do it with ultrasound guidance, and the fluoroscopy is really just confirmation that we're in the right place and everything looks good. So bringing an ultrasound machine up to the patient's bedside is actually not that burdensome. It's really the bringing the mobile fluoroscopy C-arm in to confirm that everything's in the right place. And so in order to do that, we also have to make sure all these other things are in place as well. So for example, some of the beds at Duke University Hospital have a radiolucency, so you are able to image through them up in the chest. And the reason is because it's very common to come and get a mobile chest x-ray. And so you'd want to be able to do that. And you'd want to be able to potentially place a line and look at it and have a very good look through the bed and not have to worry about that.
Yeah.
However, it's rarer for them to have that radiolucency down in the abdomen where you need more structure and support in the bed. But some of the beds do have that. So sometimes it involves transferring the patient over to a different bed in order to image through it.
In a previous podcast, we talked to folks that were running the COVID unit on hospital medicine. Mm-hmm. And one of the comments they had was about how much more challenging it is to bring the equipment into the room for that sort of, like, specifically referencing ultrasound. So here's a question that you may or may not have the answer to. The ultrasound units over at UNC hospitals, or at least some of them, they all have touch screens on them. And when you cover the touch screen, it no longer functions correctly. Are you running into like strange issues regarding, you know, infection control related to the actual technology performance over at Duke at all?
So our ultrasound units, which we would use sterilely normally in the regular course of a procedure. Mm-hmm. And so we have a normal routine where we would sterilize and then cover the part mm-hmm. of the ultrasound machine that we would interact with. And so because of that, our ultrasound units have hard physical buttons and knobs.
Yeah.
And gotcha. So then we bring those upstairs with us to okay. ensure that it'll be fine.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think they were referencing they were talking about ultrasound units that were not specifically used in sterile settings usually.
So Dr. Martin, I have a question for you actually talking about this kind of new paradigm of going to the patient instead of the patient coming to you. So kind of thinking more, people talk a lot about what are things going to look like if and when this pandemic ends. And one of the big benefits of IR being minimally invasive is that, you can potentially intervene on sicker patients who otherwise wouldn't tolerate surgery or a more invasive procedure. And so, we kind of touched on some of the learning curves of going up to the patient's room and this new method of performing IR procedures. But do you think that moving forward, there's a benefit aside from COVID where you could see a new standard of care with potentially very sick patients or unique patients going to their room to do procedures?
It would depend on the materials that we use and the machines that we use improving significantly, because currently there is a large time burden involved with going up to the patient's room. So there's a lot of preparation that goes into it. And there's a lot of additional steps and time that occurs doing the procedure. And these are all clearly worth it in the setting of COVID-19. But in a routine setting on a day in and day out basis, you would worry about fatigue and you would worry about putting a strain on the system in terms of the days running longer, procedures taking significantly longer, the pace of the day being significantly slowed down. And that's it with the current materials and machines that we have. However, if you were able to design or come up with something that would allow for a very rapid in-room safe procedure in terms of the imaging aspect of it, then I think there could be some very real benefit for going upstairs on a routine, more routine basis.
And to that end, I noticed today or yesterday that SIR, the Society of Interventional Radiology, and as I'm sure a lot of other specialty societies are doing, are offering kind of grants for people who are looking at specifically COVID-related research. And wondering if you or any of your colleagues or anyone in your department or at other institutions are kind of pursuing those kinds of avenues for either equipment that can, you know, facilitate those types of procedures or moving around or any other COVID-related innovations.
Yeah, so currently with our volumes being relatively high, the other thing that we've done is we've moved to half staff. So every day there's only 50% of the staff present. And we're working Monday, Thursday, Friday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Saturday, with the other days being days for virtual clinics, seeing patients through telehealth. We're still, you know, providing lectures and educating the residents, fellows, and the medical students. So right now in the current paradigm, we're a bit busier. And so I'm not aware of anyone who started any new research on that in our department.
Dr. Martin, can I just probe the previous statement you made a little bit? And Gabe's like right on the money because I was thinking the same question. A follow-up to the question that Gabe asked is sort of, if you had to put a rough number on it, like how much longer does it take per procedure or, you know, even a percentage wise? Could you even venture a guess?
I would say currently it probably is roughly an hour longer.
Oh, wow. And how long would the procedure normally be?
That's why it's a little bit difficult because it depends on how you're breaking down the procedure and what type of procedure it is. So, you know, a line placement, the physician's portion of that line placement is relatively quick, approximately 15 minutes. However, the nurse's portion and the technologist portion of that line placement is longer, approximately an hour in total. That's when the patient's being brought to the room and then taken out of the room. However, when you have to go upstairs and do everything now upstairs, now the physician's time in that procedure is more or less that entire hour, plus maybe some extra time for things to get ready and sterilize ahead of time and to properly don and doff all of the protective equipment. And so that becomes longer, whereas normally with patients coming to your procedure suite, the physician is able to go from room to room. Right. And the nurses and their technologists, their time is still being taken up with that patient, but not the physician's time. And so in that way, you have tiered responsibility and you're able to accomplish more in a shorter period of time. Yeah.
And I imagine your billing hasn't really changed at all either. So
correct.
It's just basically adding time and making it efficient. Interesting. And that's certainly, it's interesting because Gabe's question was right where I was headed, sort of like, what if, is this a feasible long-term thing if you could make it faster, more efficient? It seems to me like it really depends on what the procedure is and what exactly there's a lot of things that I think probably affected. Gabe, I don't know if you had any other follow-ups. That's a really interesting, now you got my mind turning on this.
Well, so one thing I'm interested in, and I think this is a little bit of a transition, but we had touched on it before when we were all chatting before this podcast recording started. But Dr. Martin, you and I have talked a lot about kind of, and everyone in IR is always talking about, you know, there's a little bit of a public awareness kind of lacking with IR. You know, when I told my family, oh, I think I'm going into interventional radiology, they were like, oh, looking at images, and people don't, there's not quite that public awareness of what the scope and breadth of procedures that IR can do. And, you know, now that you have COVID and IR is kind of in a unique place within hospitals to treat patients, not only who are acutely ill, but also those who, like you said, may have a malignancy that needs treatment and, you know, they don't want to go in for an open surgery in the hospital during this pandemic. Do you see there being an impact on kind of the future public image of IR or practice of IR moving forward after this, if and when this pandemic is over?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an opportunity for interventional radiology to improve the awareness of our specialty. However, it's not something that people in interventional radiology are too focused on, which I think is part of the problem where there's a lack of awareness of what we do. for the most part, we like to be problem solvers and to be colleagues and align with all the other specialists in the hospital and just help them get the best outcome for the patient. And so we're not generally in the role of publicizing why what we do may be better or preferred. That being said, we are certainly doing a lot of cases during COVID-19 because they're minimally invasive. They don't require as much hospital resources or protective equipment or hospital stays or general anesthesia, and they deliver near similar outcomes, which is why sometimes certain procedures may be in Europe, maybe first line to be done with interventional radiology. And then if that were to fail, then maybe the surgical option becomes the second line procedure because it is truly the more cost effective approach from a societal level. But that's not, you know, our approach to medicine in the United States. But with COVID-19, there may be some more thinking about approaching things from a societal level and what's the sort of the greatest good for the greatest number.
This is not an uncommon theme that we hear in IR at least, but you know, it got me thinking a little bit about, so Duke is obviously a leader in terms of its prestige and being an academic institution as well. And I kind of got thinking about the practices that you guys have been doing. And the question I'm going to get at here is, do you have any suggestions for folks listening to this that could be practicing either privately or academic institutions in terms of things that you guys are doing in IR that have maybe improved things better than they could have, maybe things could have gone? I guess I'm not really articulating myself well, but sort of what recommendations, if any, would you have for folks that are in IR that are listening that might help improve their practice in this particular situation with COVID?
Yeah, I mean, I think we made a number of changes that were really excellent in sort of adapting to the new paradigm. So one is we quickly converted to telehealth for all clinic visits. Basically, no clinic visits are being done in person, except for a very, very limited number. And the majority of those that need to be done in person are for, say, vascular malformations, and those are just being deferred at this time. So we quickly converted to 100% telehealth, which actually being disconnected from a physical clinic allowed for more rapid evaluation of new patients. So as new consults came in, they were essentially able to be done immediately. And one thing that was excellent about that is that the billing and reimbursement around telehealth was changed in response to the COVID-19. And so those are reimbursed at a higher rate. So there's less of a negative financial impact from that change. And I think there was a very significant clinical workflow improvement from that change. Another thing is that we did go to the two teams, and we were lucky to be supported by the hospital administration, because in going to the cohorted teams, we not only had the physicians in cohorts, but also all of the nurses and all of the technologists. So this means a complete restructuring. In theory, it would be a total restructuring of what their salary is and how they're paid. And the hospital was very accommodating and essentially just willing to pay the technologists and the nurses as if they had worked their full regular work routine hours, whether the schedule in any given week required that they work that many hours or if they actually worked fewer hours. But there was no penalty enforced on them for working fewer hours. And that made it very much easier to get everyone aligned and on board with moving to do the next thing, which was doing routine cases on Saturdays. So Previously, we were doing routine cases just Monday through Friday, Saturday and Sunday for emergent, urgent call cases only. But with going to half staff, that means we can cover fewer procedure rooms. Also, some procedures are occurring on the floors. Although the volume went down some, it didn't go down, you know, tremendously. And so we spread out some of that by having routine cases performed on Saturdays.
I was just going to say that this kind of talk about kind of administrative logistical operation standpoint changes brings up an interesting question. I think is, I heard some of the leadership at Duke talking the other day about the COVID response. And I think one good point that somebody brought up was that, you know, Duke has had the luxury of, you know, and UNC as well. So Devin, you can probably touch on this as well, but you know, they've had the luxury of longer lead times, you know, not getting inundated like New York hospitals. And so more preparation and more ability to kind of plan for what may happen and look at New York. But then, you know, you see a lot of historical innovation is kind of born out of necessity. So wondering if you've seen, you know, talking to people in New York kind of a difference in responses, particularly within IR? And also, was there kind of communication between IR departments in New York and elsewhere? You know, somebody had a good idea about operations, or vice versa, New York telling them, you know, we got slammed and this is how we dealt with it.
So I totally agree with what you were saying. We were extremely fortunate at Duke that the case volume was low and slow. And by the time we implemented social distancing in the state of North Carolina, there were still not that many cases. And so we never really had a truly explosive growth of cases. And that was really just a fortunate thing based on our geography and our demographics. So we did have lots of lead time to plan and organize. We were able to learn from other institutions. I would say that to your second question, yes, definitely. There were multiple WebExes and Zoom meetings that have been held. The Society of Interventional Radiology under Kim Kim has been holding every other week or so. Chairs from different IR divisions around the country have just been sort of zooming in and just talking about their experiences, what's changed, what's the same, et cetera, and sharing those different experiences from around the country. And that's very helpful. We had Mount Sinai in New York City led a discussion about their experience. And it was definitely very different from our experience. And we were fortunate, again, to have this lead time to organize, lead time for the School of Engineering to start printing face shields, the biocontainment laboratory to, you know, repurpose existing re-sterilization processes and use those for N95s. So we never had a shortage of supplies at Duke. And again, that was just the benefit of our demographics and our geography. Additionally, the medical school, which has an outpost in Kushan, so in the Wuhan area, they were well aware of what was coming. And so they, as you know, sent medical students out of the hospital earlier, which decreased the vector for infection, decreased the utilization of medical supplies. All of those things is that we never really even came close to running out of supplies. And so we were very fortunate in that regard. I would say it sounds like in other places, specifically New York City, one of the real big changes is that interventional radiology has gone forward. They've seen a lot more thrombosis cases. They've seen a lot more blood clots that are related to, they think, the vascular changes that are present when COVID-19 is infecting the vessel wall. But really, they saw a lot of their trainees retasked to the intensive care units working in the ICUs. So that was one of the really big changes that we were prepared for here, but we have not had to have occur.
So I think we have time for maybe one last comment here. And so we always like to ask folks that are on our podcast a magic wand question. Mm. So right now, it sounds like you guys have done a pretty good job at Duke of managing under these pandemic circumstances, but if you could sort of wave a magic wand, a proverbial magic wand, and design or implement a single change or in terms of device or workflow or supply, et cetera, with respect to IR, what would that be? Like, what would that magic wand do for you?
So this actually, Gabe, this is going to get back to one of your earlier questions, but what it would be lightweight, flawless, seamlessly integrated, augmented reality glasses that respond to personalized voice commands so that you have a patient, they need this intervention done, they're very ill, you don't want to transport them, you go upstairs, you put these glasses on, you now essentially have the imaging capabilities that you would have with fluoroscopy or a CT scanner. You could still use the ultrasound in the same way that you would otherwise, but you would be able to see augmented reality overlaid on the individual in real time, watching your catheter or, you know, wire or needle or whatever it may be entering into the exact position in that person. And of course, it would have to be seamlessly integrated. So as the patient breathes, everything moves in real time, et cetera. But that would be my magic wand device. And then that would get us to doing very, very safe bedside procedures.
That's awesome. Man, what a cool idea. That's awesome. Well, thanks for commenting and thanks for joining us today on this podcast. We really appreciate your insights from the IR perspective on COVID. And I know that we're going to have another conversation here soon to talk about your experiences just with medical device innovation and coaching as well. So we're looking forward to that. But I just wanted to say thank you very much for joining us today. And we look forward to having a conversation with you in the future.
Yeah, thank you very much for inviting me.
Yeah. Thank you, Dr. Martin. And thank you, Gabe. You guys have been listening to the Guidewire podcast, and we will talk to you next time.
We hope you enjoyed learning about some of the impacts and innovations being made in interventional radiology due to COVID-19. If you or someone you know feel they could help with any of the unmet needs discussed in today's episode, please send a message to guidewire@unc.edu. While you practice social distancing, check out our other episodes and subscribe to the Guidewire podcast on your favorite streaming service. Visit our website, guidewire.unc.edu, and follow us on Twitter, @guidewirepod. As always, I'm your host, Devin Hubbard. Stay safe. We will talk to you next time.
Learn more about our exciting activities, opportunities, and team by subscribing to the Guidewire podcast on your favorite listening service. If you have identified an unmet medical need or are interested in learning more about our process, visit us at guidewire.unc.edu. You have been listening to Guidewire, a direct line to medical device innovation.